June is a strange time to hear Isaiah 40. Normally, we expect to hear it in Advent with Handel's opening aria in the Messiah ringing in our ears. It's the reading for the Nativity of John the Baptist, which is actually coming this Sunday, so that explains it a bit. But I still think it sounds kind of strange. That's okay. I think Isaiah's words sounded a little strange in his own day. His words of consolation and comfort may be good news, but can sound a little unrealistic and hollow when they are echoing inside a prison. And the exiles, if they felt anything, they felt like prisoners. By way of contrast, the psalmist's reaction to their condition was not consolation and comfort, but grief and outrage. How can we sing songs in Zion while we sit on the riverbanks of Babylon? Blessed is he who repays you, O daughter of Babylon, with what you have done to us, who take your little ones and dash them against the rock. And furthermore, the people of Jerusalem are hardly sympathetic characters in Isaiah, with chapter after chapter describing their wickedness and hard-heartedness, their idolatry, oppression, and injustice. Like Isaiah 5, you who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter, you who are wise in your own eyes and shrewd in your own sight, they have rejected the instruction of the Lord of hosts and have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. But here, Isaiah's words to the exiles do not seethe with outrage and vengeance, but are words of comfort and consolation, of peace and promise. Perhaps the prophet sounds foolish to speak such words of comfort to the exiles while mighty Babylon is still their prison, while they remain clutched under its oppressive arm. Perhaps the prophet sounds naive to speak such generous charity and pardon for a people that have all the constancy and reliability of the grass that withers and the flower of the field that fades. But here are his words nevertheless. Comfort, comfort you, my people, says your God. Just recently, William Willimon, former dean of the chapel at Duke University and now a bishop in the United Methodist Church, he posted a story on his blog about an experience from his childhood. He says, at 10, I was minding my business in Miss McDaniel's sixth grade class, dutifully copying words off the blackboard when I got the call. Willimon, Mr. Harrelson, and Mr. Harrelson is the intimidating ancient principal, says he wants to see you. Go to his office. So shaking with trepidation, I trudged toward the principal's office. Passing an open door, a classmate looked out at me with pity, saying a prayer of thanksgiving that I was summoned to the principal and not him. And ascending the gallows, I went over in my mind all of the possible misunderstandings that could have led to this portentous subpoena. I was only a distant witness to the rock through the gym window incident, and in no way a perpetrator or even passive conspirator. But the principal said, "Listen clearly. I do not intend to repeat myself. You go down Tyndale two blocks and turn left. Go two more blocks, number 15. I need a message delivered. You tell Jimmy Spain's mother, if he's not in school by this afternoon, I'm reporting her to the police for truancy." So this wasn't about me. It was worse. God help me, Jimmy Spain, the toughest thug of all sixth grade, sixth grader who should have been in the eighth, and what's truancy? Pondering these somber thoughts, I journeyed down Tyndale, bidding farewell to the safety of the schoolyard, turned left, walked two more blocks, marveling that the world actually went on about its business while we were doing time in school. Then the last two blocks were the toughest, descending not at all at a nice part of town. Terra incognita to me, what was left of a sad neighborhood hidden behind the school. Number 15 was a small house, peeling paint, disordered yard, just the sort of house you'd expect Jimmy Spain to be holed up in, rough-looking, small but sinister. There was a big blue Buick parked in front. As I fearfully approached the walk, a man emerged, letting the front door slam, stepped off the porch and began adjusting his tie, putting on his coat. I approached him with, "Are you Mr. Spain, sir?" And just then I remembered that everybody at school said that Jimmy was so mean because he didn't have a daddy. The man looked at me, pulled his tie on tight, and guffawed, "Mr. Spain." And laughing, he left me standing there. He got into his car and sped off. I had to wait until I was in the eighth grade before someone whispered to me the dirty word for what Jimmy's mother did for a living. And until Boy Scout Court of Honor before I realized that the man that met me that day was a member of the city council. I stepped up the rotten porch and I knocked on the soiled screen door. My heart sank, for when it was opened by none other than Jimmy Spain, whose steely eyes enlarged when he saw me. And before Jimmy could say anything, the door was pulled open more widely and a woman in a faded blue terry cloth bathrobe looked down at me over Jimmy's shoulder. "What do you want?" she asked in a cold, threatening tone as I marveled at the sight of a mother in a bathrobe, even though it was early afternoon. "I'm from the school. The principal sent me to..." "The principal? What does that old fool want?" "He sent me to say that we, that is, that everybody at school misses Jimmy and wishes he were there today." "What?" she sneered, pulling Jimmy toward her just a bit. "It's like a special day today, and everybody wants Jimmy there." I think that's what he said. Jimmy, the feared thug who could beat up any kid at Donaldson Elementary, even ninth graders, any time he wanted, indeed had on multiple occasions, peered out at me in wonderment. Suddenly, this tough hood, feared by all, looked small, being clutched by his mother's protective arm, his eyes pleading, embarrassed, hanging on my every stammering word. "Well, you tell that old man it's none of his business what I do with James." "James," she said, looking down at him, "do you want to go to that old school today or not?" And Jimmy looked at me as he wordlessly nodded assent. "Well, go get your stuff and take that dollar off the dresser to buy lunch. I ain't got nothing here." And in a flash, he was away and back, and his mother stood at the door, and after making the unimaginable gesture of giving Jimmy a peck on the cheek, stood staring at us as we walked off the porch, down the walk, and back toward Tyndall Avenue. As we walked back toward the school, we said not a word to one another. I had previously lacked the courage to speak to Jimmy the Hood, and Jimmy the Tough had never had any reason, thank the Lord, to speak to me, and walking back to school that afternoon was certainly not the time to begin. We walked up the steps to the school and took a right and wordlessly turned toward the principal's office. I led him in, handed him off to the principal's secretary who received my award, and for the first time, Jimmy seemed not mean and threatening at all, but very small. And as the secretary led him away, Jimmy turned and he looked at me with a look of, I don't know, maybe regret, maybe embarrassment, rescue, but it could also have been thanks and gratitude. And that evening, when I narrated my day to my mother at supper, she said, "That is the most outrageous thing I have ever heard. Sending a young child out in the middle of the day to fetch a truant, and on that street, Mr. Harrelson ought to have his head examined. Don't you ever allow anyone to put you in that position again. Sending a child." Well, as I said, today's text has been selected for the Nativity of St. John the Baptist, a day, I suppose, that's about the sending of a child. Elizabeth, barren her whole life and now well beyond the age of childbearing, she knew that that child was sent from God. And Zechariah now knew the initial, "That is the most outrageous thing I have ever heard," had been silenced for 9 months, and now was replaced with, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people." for this child, John, would be called the prophet of the Most High. And he would go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation to his people and the forgiveness of their sins. It's strange to think that the voice of the little child heard that day, and it was a circumcision day, so you know that it was heard that day, would be the voice of one crying in the wilderness, the one which Isaiah spoke of. It's strange to think that the exile of God's people in Babylon would be deeper than living as prisoners and strangers in a foreign land, and that the path to return home would involve something even more tumultuous and profound than the lifting up of valleys and the casting down of mountains, but instead it required the paradoxical baptismal pilgrimage of repentance, in which the mighty are cast down from the thrones, and the lowly are lifted up, and the hungry are filled with good things, and the rich are sent empty away. And even stranger still is that this child sent to sound his voice in the desert would do so for the sake of another child sent with an even greater voice and an even greater message. And when this child was grown, he would stand in his home synagogue and he would read another passage from Isaiah that sounds very much like ours today. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And of course, we know that those who heard him that day thought that this was the most outrageous thing that they had ever heard. Isn't this the child of Joseph? And the missed attempt to kill him there and silence his message would soon be realized on the killing fields of yet another Babylon. Yet more outrageous still was that the silence lasted for only a couple of days. 3, to be exact. Well, June may be a strange time to hear Isaiah 40, but it's definitely the time for ordinations. I've been to 2 already. One in Alabama and one up in Iowa, and I'm attending another one next week. Actually, this story by William Willimon was really part of a sermon that he gave at an ordination service just a couple of weeks ago. And at the end of the story, he reflected on his mother's reaction at the outrageousness of sending a child on such an errand. And Willimon said that he knew that on that point, his mother was wrong. That day was the best day of my whole time at Donaldson Elementary, he said. And it was preparation for the rest of my life. My first experience of a God who thinks nothing of commandeering ordinary folk and handing them outrageous assignments. And that day, walking down Tyndale Avenue, well, that was dress rehearsal for a summer night 2 decades later when I knelt before a bishop and he laid on hands. And he pronounced the words, "You go down to Tyndale, 2 blocks, turn left, go 2 more blocks, number 15, I need you to deliver a message." Come to think of it, maybe texts like Isaiah 40 sound fine in June. And here at the seminary, considering the outrageous task that we are doing, it's certainly good to have it ringing in our ears. "Comfort, comfort my people," says your God. "Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, and that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins." Amen.